Hi, everyone. Welcome to the monthly Doctors for America policy call. We hope that this one will be very informative, especially in light of Congressman Ryan's recent budget proposal. Our guest today is Howard Gleckman. He is currently a resident fellow at the Urban Institute. He comments frequently on federal tax policy and has written quite a bit about long-term care, both in terms of personal experience and in terms of bigger picture policy issues. And he writes and edits Tax Box, which is a fiscal policy blog at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. My name is Arun Patel. I am the person who sent the email out to the invitees, but I will not be moderating the call. The moderator will be Harold Pollack, who is one of our esteemed colleagues and has been helping guide the series of policy calls. So, Harold, I'll turn it over to you for some instructions about questions and things like that, and any more you want to say about introducing Howard before we get started.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I should say that in our new format, the first Monday of every month, we'll be having our policy call, and we hope to continue to have a great lineup of people to focus on particular areas that are of interest to DFA members. And the focus of today's call is really focusing on a set of issues related to long-term care and sort of the fiscal knot that we're in right now. However, we have we've covered a range of issues, and we're always interested in learning more. If you have questions that you would like to ask Mr. Gleckman tonight, please send us an email to info@doctorsforamerica.org, drsforamerica.org, or you can always send me an email at haroldpollack@gmail.com, and or Arun, and we can get those questions going. There, after the call is over, you'll receive an email with a survey that asks you some questions about the call, and that gives you some information and some web links for some articles that came up. That's. I think that's all. Have I gotten all the bookkeeping out of the way at this point? Have I put everybody to sleep before we even started? With that, I guess Howard, why don't you take it away, and I'll ask questions as we go along. But interested in getting your perspective.
Okay, great. Well, Harold, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's a great pleasure to be with everybody this evening. As Arun said in his introduction, I live in the intersection of fiscal policy and long-term care policy, which to some people seems a little odd, but increasingly as we're looking at the budget proposals that are out there, that intersection is getting more and more interesting, and probably more and more crowded too. What I'd like to do is just take a few minutes before we get started with questions to just kind of very briefly walk through long-term care, because I think there are a lot of misconceptions about it. So let me just briefly describe what it is, how we pay for it, and how it's delivered. Essentially, 10 million Americans receive long-term care in the United States now, and 20 years from now, that number will double. My definition of long-term care, there are many definitions, but my definition of long-term care is it's a personal assistance that people with chronic disease need to live the fullest life possible. My expertise is really in long-term care of the elderly and younger adults with disabilities. There is another world out there of children with developmental disabilities. I have very little expertise in that area, so mostly as I'm talking, think about the context of older adults and adults under 65 who may have suffered from disease or accident, and who find themselves needing long-term care as well. it's interesting when I talk to lay people, most often they, when I say long-term care, they think nursing home. But in fact, 80% of people receiving long-term care in the United States get it at home. The nursing home population accounts for perhaps 10%. And the rest live in assisted living facilities or group homes or other settings. The cost of this care is staggeringly expensive, particularly by the standards of the kind of savings that most Americans have. Skilled nursing facility on average costs $80,000 a year. Assisted living is $35,000 to $40,000 a year. And the cost of a home health aide averages about $20 an hour. If you hire that aide through an agency. To put that in some context, the median net worth of a household 65 and older in the United States, financial net worth, is less than $150,000. One in six have retirement savings of less than $10,000. And it's also important to keep in mind, and I guess we'll be talking a little bit about Medicare on this call as well, that the out-of-pocket medical cost of a couple 65 and over exceeds $200,000. So you can see that the numbers don't add up even before you begin to think about long-term care costs. Overall, in the United States, the cost of long-term care exceeds $200 billion annually. Medicaid is overwhelmingly the largest payer, probably pays between 40 and 50%. Private long-term care insurance, by contrast, picks up less than 10%, depending on who you talk to, maybe 7 or 8%. Most care, however, I think it's important to note, is not paid care. Most care is informal family care. The AARP has put an economic value on that care in excess of $375 billion. So essentially, this is a system that is built on families caring for their loved ones at home. But at some point, many people, particularly the frail elderly, do reach a situation where they need paid assistance, and that's, of course, where Medicaid comes in. Medicaid itself, you're probably all familiar with the rules. Essentially, you have to be very poor and very sick. This is a program that's jointly run by the states and the federal government. Federal government pays about 60% of the cost of Medicaid. The states pay the rest. But the variation among states is quite wide. In states like Connecticut, it's about 50-50. In states like Mississippi, the federal government picks up about 80% of the cost. Medicaid, of course, was created in 1965 as a program primarily to provide medical care to poor mothers and their children. And even now, the vast majority of participants in the Medicaid program are, in fact, poor mothers and their children. But the bulk of the cost, two-thirds of the cost of Medicaid, is for the disabled and the elderly. And half of that, or about one-third of the total cost, or about $120 billion, is for long-term care for the elderly and the disabled. So this is becoming a program that increasingly is not for the originally intended participants. It's for the elderly and the disabled, and it is a program that is increasingly financially unsustainable. So the question we're all facing now is, what are we going to do about it? And I think I'll stop there with the basics, and we can have some questions and go on from there.
Actually, you just left off with Medicaid, one of the obvious policy hooks I should ask you about is the Ryan budget plan, which certainly makes some pretty radical suggestions for Medicaid. Can you say a little bit about what you think is most pertinent in that plan as relates to the issues that you were just talking about and things that we should either be concerned about or paying attention to, that Representative Ryan's proposed?
Sure. And full disclosure here, I will say that in my perfect world, I would get Medicaid entirely out of the long-term care business. I think it does an exceedingly bad job of it. And I think there's a lot to be said for turning this into an insurance-based system rather than a welfare-based system. And there's a lot of interesting discussion about what that insurance-based system would look like. Would it be private insurance? Would it be social insurance, a government Medicare kind of a program? What would we do? And that's an interesting discussion. But I don't think Medicaid is the appropriate place for it. Nonetheless, that's where it is. What Congressman Ryan, and actually we can now say what the United States House of Representatives has approved as a budget framework, is a plan initiated by Ryan that would cap the federal contribution to Medicaid. In other words, what happens now is if Medicaid costs increase by 5% a year, the federal contribution to Medicaid increases by 5% a year, not 5 percentage points, but 5% a year. It rises simply with the cost of the program. Ryan would fundamentally change this, and he would say the federal government would pay only a fixed amount of money that would increase, let us say, by the inflation rate. Exactly how that's going to work is not really clear, but it would be a fixed amount of money, and the sum of it is that the states would be required to pay a larger and larger share of the cost of the Medicaid program. Now, Ryan does not distinguish between the long-term care costs of Medicaid and the medical costs of Medicaid. He would simply throw all this in a pot and say to the states, you can do what you want. He would give the states maximum flexibility in spending this money, and they could divide this money up any way they wanted. It's one other point that I didn't mention in the introduction that's probably important to put in here. Is the entitlement, the so-called entitlement for long-term care under Medicaid, is for nursing home care only. Most states do operate what are called home and community-based waiver programs that do allow people to receive Medicaid benefits at home, but those programs are not an entitlement. The states can run them pretty much as they wish once they get a waiver. And they vary quite dramatically from state to state. In some states, there's no waiver at all. In some states, the waiver is a very minimal amount of money, provides a home care benefit on paper, but in practice, an insufficient benefit for people to work, for it to work for people. And in other states, it's actually a relatively generous program and works quite well. That's the kind of a thing that would happen under the Ryan plan. States would have this maximum flexibility. You would see some states that presumably would continue to offer a relatively decent long-term care benefit. You would see other states that would offer a very poor long-term care benefit. And cuts would be made clearly to providers, nursing homes, hospitals, physicians, all of whom provide Medicaid services, would almost certainly see their reimbursements reduced in this environment where the federal government is contributing less money.
Now, one question about that. So the House has passed this. It seems like it's dead on arrival when it gets to the Senate. But how does the existence of the Ryan plan change what American public policy is going to look like in 5 or 10 years? What's the real impact of this thing, given that it's not going to be, it seems to me that that it's so extreme that it's not going to be enacted in its current form.
I think, Harold, it's already had an impact. President Obama, of course, gave a speech a couple of weeks ago in response, really, to the Ryan plan. The White House would deny that's what it was, but that was what it was. And Ryan, the estimate is that Ryan's budget would cut the federal contribution to Medicaid by about $800 billion over 10 years. Obama has countered with a proposal that would cut the federal contribution to Medicaid by $100 billion over 10 years. So I think what Ryan has done is he's put the whole state and federal relationship on Medicaid on the table. And Obama is kind of playing on that, if I can mix the metaphor, he's kind of playing on that field already. So I think the question is not, will the federal contribution to Medicaid be cut? and will states get more flexibility in the way they run the program? I think the question now is how much will it be cut, and how much flexibility are the states going to get as they operate this program going forward? So I think Ryan has actually had already kind of a tremendous impact in kind of changing the way this issue is framed.
It seems also that there's a crop of Republican governors who find the Ryan plan attractive, but in the long run, this is really a disaster for state governments.
I'll tell you, my guess is that this is really all about politics. That there's no governor in his right mind who actually wants to see the federal contribution to Medicaid cut. What the governors do want, though, is they want maximum flexibility. And
now,
how
would they use that flexibility? Are there things that we should be encouraging states to be able to do that they can't do now? I've heard people say we should allow them to be more. We should allow greater flexibility, but it seems to me that most of that flexibility is in cutting essential benefits for people. Are there things that really they have a legitimate need for flexibility that should be addressed?
Well, we're already seeing this on the acute care side, on the healthcare side. Rhode Island is, I think, the classic example where it has gotten a waiver for what's known as a kind of a global waiver, which allows Rhode Island to do essentially anything it wants on the acute care side, on the healthcare side. And what states are doing is they're turning Medicaid into a managed care program. This is not what was originally contemplated, but it's where states are going. They think they can save a lot of money by doing this, and of course they say they can also provide good quality care. This is one of these kind of interesting sorts of issues. I believe very strongly that the frail elderly who have multiple chronic disease absolutely need to have their care coordinated, have their care managed, if you will. But the question is it going to be managed to their benefit, or is it going to be managed simply for the purposes of saving money? And that kind of remains to be seen. It's harder to see what would happen with long-term care. There are some people who talk about managed long-term care. That's a little harder to figure out. But clearly what states would do, what the governors say they would do if they had the flexibility, is they would provide much more in the way of home care, much less in the way of institutional care, nursing home care and that sort of thing. This is an idea which is very attractive to most advocacy groups who hate the idea of nursing homes, who think that benefits ought to be made available for people to age in place. The problem with that is there are many people, because of the nature of their disease or because of an absence of family caregivers, who simply can't get care at home. Think about, for example, an 85-year-old widow with dementia who has no children or whose children are living in a distant city. It may not be safe for her to actually live at home. So for her, some sort of institutional level of care might be necessary. There's a question about whether that care would be available in this sort of maximally flexible benefit system. The other thing to keep in mind about this is the federal dollars come with, particularly the stimulus dollars that the Obama administration gave out to states over the last couple of years, comes with something called a maintenance of effort requirement. And essentially, that says that states are prohibited from cutting benefits. However, what they can do is they can cut reimbursement. I get the sense that what many states would like as a political compromise here is for that maintenance of effort plan to go away. Again, they'd like to keep the federal money, but without the strings and without the requirement that they provide a fixed minimum benefit to recipients. I think they'd like to be able to cut that benefit some, either by limiting the actual benefits that are provided or by limiting eligibility. There's kind of two ways they can go there.
Now, is there, under health reform, a lot of something like 16 million new people are going to be brought into Medicaid, in large part because of the raising of the income eligibility to 133% of poverty.
That is correct.
How does that, and I know most of those people, the federal government will pay for just about all of the cost of their coverage, but how does that enter into this conversation?
Yeah, this is a very interesting piece of the puzzle. The federal government has agreed to pay for most of the cost of those added acute care health care participants in Medicaid. It's important to keep in mind that that additional enrollment is only for people under 65. So we're not talking about for the most part the long-term care population. We're talking about younger people. We're talking about these moms and their kids. And the federal government has agreed to pay for most of the cost of those additional participants, except that the federal share shrinks gradually over 10 years. And the governors are, I think not without reason, very concerned that as the federal government faces this budget crunch, that federal contribution is going to shrink. And the states are going to be left holding the bag for those new Medicaid participants. That's another reason why they would like to get this additional flexibility, because they'd like to be able to change some of those eligibility rules.
Well, of course, you could also, if there was some federal legislation that extended that made more credible over a longer period of time the federal matching rate, that would be another way to help with that, but you'd have to acknowledge the expenditures on the federal budget.
Yeah, and given the fiscal pressure here, I think that a federal promise that it really, really would continue to pay this isn't going to be worth very much. We know we're in an environment where over the next few years, the federal fiscal policy is going to change in some pretty dramatic ways. So a promise that the federal government's going to pay something in 10 years is probably not worth much.
Right. Speaking of federal government and its fiscal pressures, we should also mention the Medicare aspects of the what we can call the House budget plan. What are some things that deserve attention on the Medicare side in addition to the Medicaid issues we've just been talking about?
Well, the Medicare change is probably the most dramatic proposal that the House Republicans have enacted, or Ryan has proposed. Essentially, what he would do is abolish Medicare as we know it, the idea of a federal health insurance program for the elderly would go away. Instead, what would happen is the federal government would provide seniors with either you call it a voucher or a premium support, depending on who you are, but essentially a cash subsidy that those seniors could use to buy insurance in the private market. Now, you could actually make an argument that going to a kind of a premium support system is not a bad idea. It would avoid some of the really awful bureaucratic problems that Medicare has in terms of delivery of care. The problem is that the reason Medicare was created in the first place was because seniors who nearly all had pre-existing conditions couldn't buy insurance on the open market. They couldn't do this in 1965, and they can't do it now. So the question, I've asked Ryan's staff this question, the Ryan proposal, remember, there's two pieces to it. One of them is to change the fundamental nature of Medicare by turning it into a cash subsidy program rather than an insurance program. The second change is to repeal the provisions of the Obama health law that require insurance companies to sell to all comers and create the insurance exchanges. So the question is, well, if you're telling seniors that there's no longer going to be Medicare, and you abolish the provisions in the law that allow them to buy insurance on an open market without being underwritten out of the product, what are you left with? You're left with eventually 77 million seniors who have no way to actually buy insurance. Ryan's response is, well, we are going to have a mechanism for them to buy the insurance, but it's different from Obama's exchanges. And when I ask them how it is different, they can't actually tell me. So I think Ryan has kind of got himself in a box here. The best thing that could happen to him would be to allow the Obama health plan to actually become law, so that seniors could in fact buy on exchanges with guaranteed issue. In that situation, he might actually be able to make a case that that a subsidized private insurance program would work. The argument then, though, would be how big would the subsidy be? And that's, of course, subject for another huge debate.
Yeah, and I must say the argument that that's a cost-saving move is not supported in the empirical literature. They would also, by the way, gradually increase the retirement age from 65 to 67.
That's correct.
And that would also be a big change, and it would also shift some costs onto state government.
Mm-hmm.
I want to come back, actually. We started talking about Medicaid, and I wanted to make sure we covered the Medicare dimension because it's so important. But I want to come back to Medicaid for a minute. But one is, a lot of DSA members are physicians who take care of Medicaid patients. The reimbursement rates are so low, and it's really a tremendous problem for everybody. Is there anything that can be done to deal with? It seems to me that states are, if anything, the incentives are to ratchet down on those reimbursement rates in the coming years.
I think that's exactly right. I think provider payments, whether it's nursing homes, whether it's physicians, are just going to continue to go lower. And there is a real issue here about whether or not providers are going to continue to participate in the Medicaid program. You know, you just talked about physicians and the challenges they have. I've talked to a number of nursing home operators over the last year or two, both for-profit and non-for-profit, who are essentially saying that they will reduce, they are already in the process of reducing the number of Medicaid long-term care beds that they offer. It is far more lucrative for them to turn those beds into Medicare post-acute rehabilitation beds than to continue as long-term care providers. They can get, for example, for rehabilitation for Medicare, $400 or $500 or maybe even $600 a day, whereas depending on the state, maybe they're getting $100 or $150 a day for the Medicaid bed. The numbers just don't work. You have some states that require nursing homes to provide a certain number of beds for the indigent, and they'll continue to do that. But to the degree that nursing homes can kind of get out of this business, I think they will. And again, you know, advocates for the elderly and disabled, for the most part, think that's a great idea. But I think it is important to recognize that there are going to be some patients who need a level of care that they simply simply not appropriate for them at home.
I must say that one of the things that your last comment reminds me of is, I think rhetorically that the Democrats have really made an error by allowing the term entitlement crisis to kind of encompass Medicare and Medicaid together as a single problem. And it seems to me that we really need to be spending more money on Medicaid, and that the program, you know, its cost growth over time has been, per person, per enrollee has been quite reasonable, and it's even projected to be pretty reasonable when you go out to 2035 and you consider all the new people that are coming on. And as opposed to Medicare, which is really on a very unsustainable trajectory, and if the public policy debate is framed around the idea that we have to constrain Medicaid costs, we really can't deal with the fundamental problems of the program very well.
No, I think that's right. I think it's worth keeping in mind that when you talk about Medicaid, that a third of the Medicaid budget is not health care. It's long-term care. And I think it's one of the reasons why the Medicaid cost numbers look a little different than the Medicare cost numbers do, because Medicaid long-term care is increasing at a relatively low rate, particularly relative to the increase in health care costs. So when you have a third of the budget that's rising, you know, more slowly, it does make the numbers look a little bit better. And as we were just saying, you know, one of the other ways that Medicaid is saving money is it is dramatically, well, not cutting, but in large degree freezing compensation to providers, so that they're not even able to recoup their additional cost of living expenses. So Medicaid has got some sustainability issues as well, but I agree with you that it doesn't make a lot of sense to conflate Medicare and Medicaid. They're two very different programs. They're for two very different populations. You know, I don't think it makes sense either to talk about them as if they were the same thing. And for that matter, throw in Social Security and talk about that as if it were the same thing as Medicare or Medicaid.
Yeah, Social Security really is a much more manageable, much less frightening problem in terms of the budget numbers.
Absolutely.
I also want to make sure we get to a topic that's near and dear to me, which some people on the call know a lot about and some people on the call know nothing about, which is the CLASS Act. And maybe we could start by, I think you're probably one of the 12 people in the country who really understand the CLASS Act. It's sort of astonishing that this is a hundreds of billions of dollar program that was put in health reform, and I wonder how many people even know that it's there.
Yeah, nobody noticed. It's pretty remarkable. So the CLASS Act is a provision of the Affordable Care Act, the 2010 health law, that provides a universal voluntary, I guess you can't really call it universal, a voluntary government long-term care insurance program. And the idea is that everybody who is working a minimal amount of time, starting at age 18, will be eligible to buy this insurance. The insurance will be provided by the government. They would get a benefit, which would be in cash. It would be for life, assuming they met the test for needing assistance with activities of daily living, essentially the same test that you required for private insurance. If you met that test, you would get a benefit of somewhere around $50 or $60 or $70 a day for life in cash. It is a voluntary program, but it is also designed as what's known as an opt-out program. What would happen is if your employer chose to participate in the program, you would be automatically enrolled unless you chose to opt out. This is a design that some of the listeners might be familiar with that happens now a lot in 401k plans. You would be eligible to receive benefits after 5 years, after you pay premiums for 5 years, known as a five-year vesting period. You notice as I described it, I didn't say what the premium was because nobody actually knows what the premium is going to be. The parameters that I just described are the parameters in the law. There was a lot of concern at the time the law was being written that an insurance program built like this was not sustainable. I, among other people, wrote a lot during the period of the debate saying that this was a program that was very poorly designed. In recent months, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, has acknowledged that the language of the statute creates an insurance program that is probably not sustainable. So they are now busily trying to see if they can design a plan that can actually work. And the problem is basically this. Remember that I said at the beginning that you're eligible for this program even if you work a very limited amount. The actual standard in the program is if you earn $1,200 a year, you are eligible to pay premiums and participate in the program. That standard makes it possible for people who already have disabilities but who are working to purchase this coverage. I happen to think that it's an excellent idea to take people who can work, who have disabilities and can work, and decouple a benefit from Medicaid. Doesn't make any sense because one of the things that Medicaid does is it limits the amount of money you can make. It forces you to be poor, even if you can work. So this program would decouple benefits for working people with disabilities from the Medicaid program. I think that's a terrific idea. The problem is that for those people, this isn't insurance. This is just a benefit program. They know they're going to need the benefit. They probably need the benefit from the day they begin paying the premiums. So essentially, they can pay 5 years of premiums, and in return for that, they can get a daily benefit for the rest of their life. This is a new benefit program, but it's not being paid for by the entire population. It's only being paid for by the fraction of people who choose to buy insurance to hedge against their risk of needing long-term care in old age. Because of that design, people who want to buy the insurance are going to end up paying a very, very high premium. And consequently, many people who might have been interested in purchasing the insurance won't, because it's just too expensive. So you've got a new benefit program that's being subsidized by a limited number of people. It is a recipe for failure. So what they're trying to do is figure out some way to strengthen the at-work requirement, to create some other standards so people, you don't have too many people in the risk pool here who are not purchasing insurance, but they're just kind of enrolling in a benefit program. How they do that is a real challenge. Sebelius has talked about taking this $1,200 a year standard and making it $12,000 a year. There are some questions about whether she's really got the legal authority to do that. But all of this is around the question of, can you design a program that works for the maximum number of people, but whose premium is reasonable enough that people are actually going to participate in it? No one knows what this premium is going to be. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated it's probably going to be in the neighborhood of $120 a month on average, less for younger people, more for older people. The Medicare actuary has said that he thinks the premium is going to be $240 a month. The data I've looked at suggests that even at $120 a month, the participation rate is going to be very, very low, probably somewhere in the single digits, which, not coincidentally, is about what the participation rate is for private long-term care insurance.
There was a recent analysis, by the way, that said that the average premium would be about $194, that's what's required for this to really be sustainable. For people that are listening in, I wonder how many people would actually be willing to buy this kind of an insurance policy for $194 a month for a pretty affluent, educated group of people. I just wonder how many people would be willing to do that, or how many employers would be willing to set up an opt-out system for their employees when the benefit at stake is that expensive.
Yeah, there's kind of nothing in it for employers to participate in. If your employer does not participate, this opt-out design doesn't happen. You have to affirmatively make a decision to enroll through a process that we don't yet know. I think that's right. I mean, the real issue is the premium is just too high. There's a lot of research out there that suggests that there's an inflection point at somewhere in the neighborhood of $80 to $100 a month, and that if the premium exceeds that number, you're going to get very low participation.
I just had a question that came over the email. Are there any kind of survivor benefits connected to the CLASS Act? I don't believe that there are.
No, there are not. This works very much like traditional private long-term care insurance in that there are no survivor benefits. It's private insurance is struggling to try to create what they call a combo product that would combine long-term care insurance with an annuity that would, depending on how much you're willing to pay, have a survivor benefit, but CLASS does not have that. It's also worth mentioning that as we talk about this as a voluntary government program, that nearly every other major developed country in the world has looked at the issue starting in the 1990s, and almost every single one of them, with the exception of the United States and the United Kingdom, has gone to a universal long-term care insurance system, usually funded by payroll taxes or premiums or a combination of payroll taxes, premiums, and general revenues. France has done it, Germany's done it, Japan has done it, Israel, Spain, you kind of take the grand tour of the world. Just about everybody has gone that route. We, of course, were not willing to do that, and we created this voluntary system. To be frank about it, I don't think there's really any way to make a voluntary program work.
Do you think is going to happen, given that we're in this political gridlock right now, and it seems to me even the ability to tinker with the program is pretty limited?
I think there's probably a 50-50 chance that this program will be killed before any policies are ever sold. Republicans have made an absolute fetish of killing this program. They want to, of course, get rid of all the health reform law, but they really want to get rid of this provision. And the difference between this one and much of the rest of the health law is there are a number of Senate Democrats, of moderate to conservative Senate Democrats, who also oppose this. So it would, of course, be quite easy for Republicans to get legislation repealing the CLASS Act out of the House. This is one where they might even actually have enough votes, when you add in the Democratic votes, to actually pass repeal in the Senate as well. Now, Obama would veto such a bill if it were a freestanding bill. I think it's more likely that what will happen is when they do some sort of omnibus budget bill for fiscal year 2012, you know, they just did the omnibus bill for fiscal 2011, and they're just starting the debate for fiscal 2012, that when they eventually do a budget bill for 2012, probably sometime next fall, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if buried in that bill is a repeal of CLASS or a defunding of CLASS, and it could very well actually happen. So this may be murdered in its crib before we actually ever see an insurance policy.
So what you'd like to see, it sounds like you would be willing to get rid of it if it were replaced by something that were more properly designed.
Yeah, I wouldn't get rid of it. I mean, I think this idea of repealing something and then going back and starting again is fairly stupid. You know, I think the way you do it is you build on what's there, and you design an insurance program that can actually work. And you know, that's going to require some trade-offs, but the key to it is a premium in the $80 to $100 range. I very much like two things about the CLASS Act. One of them is it is a step down the road towards turning long-term care into an insurance system rather than a welfare system. As I said at the beginning, I think Medicaid is just an awful way to try to provide long-term care services. The other thing I like very much about CLASS is the cash benefit. The cash benefit makes it more expensive, but it also gives people the opportunity to design a long-term care program that works for them. Everyone is in a different situation. Everyone has different level of disability. They have different levels of family support. One of the big problems with Medicaid is that it is very much rules-based, very much based on fraud prevention, rather than trying to provide a care system that works for people who need long-term care and their families. And I think a cash benefit would go some way towards making that system work a lot more smoothly for people. I should also note that a lot of people are very critical of a $50 a day benefit. They say that, you know, that doesn't do anybody any good. I actually disagree. I think that if you're somebody who can receive care at home, $50 a day is 3 hours of home health aid time. It's the cost of an adult day program. So there's actually a lot you could do with $50 or $60 a day. It would have to be supplemented probably with private funds, but it would make a lot of difference. It would also make a lot of difference for those caregivers, adult children, adult daughters mostly, who are trying to balance caring for their parents with a job and with their own kids and with caring for their own kids. And having somebody who could come in 3 or 4 hours a day would make all the difference for people like that. So I'm not as dismissive of that $50 a day premium as some people are.
By the way, I've gotten an email asking, for what reason are the Democrats against CLASS?
The Democrats who are opposed to CLASS are opposed to it for two reasons. There's kind of a a policy reason and a political reason. The political reason is that many of them are in states where they represent large private long-term care insurance companies. So, for example, Senator Warner from Virginia is one of the strong critics. It happens that Genworth, which is the largest seller of private long-term care insurance, is located in Richmond, Virginia. So I think he's doing this to some degree at the request of constituents. The other reason has to do with a very complicated budget situation. You might remember when I first described this that I said there was a five-year vesting period. What that essentially means is class will collect premiums for a period of 5 years before it pays anything out in benefits. The Congressional Budget Office, by the convention of the way it scores things, added this up and concluded that within the 10-year budget window that it looks at, the CLASS Act will generate $70 billion more than it will pay out in premiums. That money was used, if you will, talking kind of very loosely here, was used to help make the health reform law look like it was a budget saver and not a budget loser. It was one of the elements that made the health law look less expensive than it probably is over the long term. Republicans and some fiscal conservative Democrats were apoplectic at this. They said that this was a budget gimmick. They called it Bernie Madoff, Ponzi scheme. They were just furious. As a matter of budget accounting, they're not entirely wrong. But, you know, the argument that I've made is, you know, this is not an exercise about budget accounting. This is an exercise about trying to figure out a way to finance long-term care for people. So, fix the budget issue if you want. I don't really care about how you score it. The real issue is, you know, is there a way to salvage this program so that people have some option to pay for their long-term care when they need it. The other problem for fiscal conservatives is their belief that this program is in fact unsustainable. You're going to have a fraction of the population that will enroll, and the program will die before they actually collect premiums. The only way they'll get those premiums will be the government will just have to write checks. They say this is creating a new federal entitlement program. They hate that too.
I kind of like the federal entitlement program, but I think that's not. I'm
kind of
not
a strange way to get to it, but yeah.
I agree. Now we have another question that says, "Isn't the significant problem with cash benefit programs that they have potentially high private administrative costs and problems for people who need much more care than the benefit would be able to pay for?"
The administrative cost shouldn't be particularly higher with a cash benefit than they would be with a reimbursement program. There are questions about fraud. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, you'd have to have some provisions in place to prevent fraud, no question. But that doesn't mean that you don't do it. What was the second question? I'm sorry.
Oh, just that for people who need much more care than the benefit would really pay for. So you have someone who really needs to go into a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And they're entitled to $50 a day in benefits.
Yeah, the sponsors of the law, Senator Kennedy and the other people who sponsored the law, explicitly anticipated that private insurance would sell a wraparound policy to supplement class. Think of this as the long-term care equivalent to Medigap insurance. So you'd have the basic government program, and then you could buy supplemental insurance from private insurance companies that would kind of fit in with this. Again, it's a terrific idea. I think as designed, it's unlikely it would happen for a couple of reasons. One of them, again, is that after you've finished paying $120 or $150 a month in premiums for the government program, are you really going to have any money left to buy a private insurance policy as well? The other problem is a very troubling one for those who want to see class succeed, and that is that private insurance companies won't sell policies to wrap around class insurance. Instead, what they'll do is they'll sell against class, and it will work like this. Because class insurance is not underwritten, the government insurance will attract people who are more likely than normal to need coverage. that will leave a large population of people who are unlikely to need coverage to buy private insurance. The private insurers will then be able to sell them a class-like benefit for less money than the federal government, but underwrite it. So what will happen is that all of the risks will go to the federal government, and all of the relatively riskless buyers will end up buying private insurance for a fairly low premium. This will be very profitable for the insurance companies, and it will make a disaster for the feds.
So it seems to me this is all an argument for some sort of an individual mandate or a universal program that really you can't kind of set up half a voluntary program that is vulnerable to adverse selection. Although, given where we are politically, that's the thing that's the easiest thing to try to get passed.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I mean, again, in my perfect world, I would do a mandate. I would do what everybody else in the world has done. But, I mean, you know, you got to recognize the politics. I mean, you know, we couldn't even get a public option in the health law for health insurance. The idea of getting a mandatory long-term care insurance program is just not in the cards. It would be nice, but it's not going to happen. So given that, given that the best that's going to happen here is the program won't get repealed, I think it's probably best that people work to find a way to redesign this. And again, this redesign would probably be much less beneficial to working people with disabilities, but it's probably the price of saving the program at all. I should say that when Senator Kennedy started this whole exercise back some years ago, the elderly population was very much an afterthought for him. He was really thinking about younger people with disabilities. I think about this in a very different way. I think about this as real insurance, and as a program that really is important for those people looking to purchase actual insurance and hedge against the future risk. Rather than a benefit program, which just is not ever going to happen in the current political environment.
Just given we're approaching the end of the hour, a couple of final questions. One is another by email. So if the nature of American politics is to put out fires rather than to plan far ahead, what do you think the next fire is going to be, and how can we get a little bit ahead of the curve in addressing it?
I think we can. This is a fire that we can see. I mean, the debate over the next 3 to 5 years is going to be only about what we're going to do about the budget deficit, assuming we don't fall back into recession or there's not some, you know, exogenous event somewhere in the Middle East or something like that.
We've had some good exogenous events lately.
We had a pretty good one. Yeah, yesterday, but you never know. I think that's the debate, and I suspect, you know, we're not going to resolve this before the 2012 presidential election, but I suspect that in that presidential election, there's going to be a lot of discussion about what the nature of social insurance is in the United States. And beyond that, what is the nature of, you know, solidarity versus rugged individualism in the United States? You know, I think what needs to happen here is we really do need to have a serious conversation about, you know, what we feel our obligations are to one another in this country and whether we're willing to pay for them. You know, we've had a period of time where we have bought all sorts of things that we really we could afford, but we chose to not pay for them, and that's not sustainable. I was just looking the other day at in this argument over the debt limit, you have all these politicians who say don't extend the debt limit. We just voted, you know, in this legislation to prevent the government shutdown in the middle of April. We voted for a budget that spent $3.5 trillion, but raised only $2.2 trillion in taxes. Consequently, we have a $1.3 trillion deficit. there's only one place to get that money from. You've got to borrow it. And now we say we don't want to borrow it either. You know, this is just nuts. So it seems to me that what we have to do is we have to have a real serious conversation about what it is we want to do and how it is we want to pay for it. And certainly, you know, in my little world, long-term care has got to be a piece of that discussion. Americans don't save. I gave you some numbers at the beginning of the call about you know what poor savers we really are. You know, but we have this need, and it's a need that is going to grow as we age. I didn't mention, I just very briefly mentioned because I know we are running out of time, but I did not mention when I was talking about these budget cuts, you know, not only is Medicaid being cut, but also this whole range of ancillary services that are non-Medicaid programs but that people need if they're going to get care at home, Meals on Wheels, transportation, subsidized housing. You can't live at home unless you've got a place to live. The information and referral services. All of these things are either being frozen or cut in the current budget and probably will be cut more in the future budgets. So you have this whole range of Medicaid and non-Medicaid services that people need. They're being cut. You have the idea of a government insurance program. It's insufficient and poorly designed. So we don't have an answer, but we have a problem. You know, I mean, the problem isn't going away. In fact, as the boomers age, the problem is just going to get worse and worse. We will live a very long time in this country with chronic disease. That is a tribute to the physicians on this call and to medical science. But we have not prepared in any way for the care we're going to need during a period of debility. And we've got to do it. We've got to figure out some way to do it. You can't just say, well, this one doesn't work and that one doesn't work, but I don't have any alternatives. There needs to be some sort of an option here, and I don't see it yet.
The final question, since you've laid out quite a dilemma, is are there things that the medical community could do, particularly the kinds of activist physicians that are listening in right now, that the physician community could do to be helpful in presenting this issue to the public in a way that would generate positive movement?
I think there are two things that the physician community can do, and they're things that are very uncharacteristic and the kinds of things that physicians would generally say, I think, this is not my job. But I think in this new environment we're in, it would be very helpful if the physician community did it. The first thing is when you see younger patients, you know, baby boomer patients or even patients in their 40s, you know, talk to them about the fact that you know, that 70% of people over 65 will need some long-term care in their old age, and they should begin to plan for it. I know physicians are not financial planners, but the physicians have a tremendous amount of influence on their patients to the degree that you can just simply say to people, this is something that is very likely to happen to you, and you need to begin to plan for it. That would be helpful. The other thing is I very strongly believe that as government resources shrink, and they will shrink, the argument is only going to be about by how much, that communities have got an obligation to begin to provide some of this care themselves. Obviously, communities can't act as, you know, neighbors can't act as home health aides. They certainly can't act as physicians or physician assistants. But they can do some things. They can prepare meals for neighbors. They can help neighbors with rides. They can pick up things at the grocery store. They can call them or visit them. These are little things that people can do to make the best of what is going to be a very difficult situation. And to the degree that physicians, as influential members of their community, can encourage this sort of support, and it can happen through neighborhoods, it can happen through churches or synagogues or social organizations. There are all kinds of ways it can happen, but I think very strongly that in what is likely to be a period of constrained government support, that we need to figure out ways to begin to provide this assistance as best we can ourselves. And I think there is a role for physicians in encouraging that.
Thanks, Ed. What a great place to end the call. Thanks so much, and thanks, everyone, for joining us. This has been a great learning experience, and so you'll be receiving an email from us with a post-call survey, but thank you very much, and we'll see everybody next month. And thanks
great.
Again, Howard, for coming and joining us.
Pleasure to be on. Good luck with to you all for everything you're doing. I know you're all working hard to try to figure out ways to make this better, and I wish you luck. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Good night, everybody.